Game On.
On 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game On, weeknights from 6.
On 2FM.
Thanks to the Dew Johnnies, it's Tuesday the 3rd of May and this is Game On. Coming up on the show, Kevin Doyle sets the scene for us ahead of the Champions League semi-final clash between Liverpool and Villarreal.
Ken Doherty will join us to look back on Ronnie O'Sullivan's victory last night at the Crucible. We'll also have the recently retired Paddy Maher on the line to talk life after hurling and Pieta House's darkness into light walk. Plus Mark Langdon even to discuss tonight's championship battle between Notts Forest and Bournemouth and all things European.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Marie, our trip to New York to do Game On, it's not lasting long, is it?
I still have a bit of hope because it does seem like there's an awful lot to be sorted out. A little bit earlier today, The Independent were reporting that the plan had changed a little bit and it looked like it could be heading for Croke Park in October, that Katie Taylor, Amanda Serrano rematch. But it does seem that talks have taken place all right today in Croke Park. Apparently, Brian Peters was back in Ireland and working on trying to sort out the situation where Amanda Serrano and Katie Taylor could fight in Croke Park in October. But you'd have to imagine that it's an awful lot more difficult than it sounds trying to pull it off. The issue, one of the main issues, being the American market. So a lot of the zone subscribers where the fight would be shown are in America. So trying to figure out if you can get them on board, given the fact that they probably won't be able to see it at a time that they would like to see it, would obviously be a big issue. Maybe it could be live on RTE, which would be pretty epic as well. Then obviously getting Serrano as well to agree to come over here, and then trying to sort out Croke Park too, because they've had a number of concerts and will have had a number of concerts by the end of the year. But one question that seems to be answered, Ruby, is one that you were asking yesterday, which is how many people can attend the fight. So it seems that while when it comes to concerts, the way the stage is set up, that often takes the hill out of play. But with the boxing match, they reckon it could be 90,000 in Croke Park for this fight, because you wouldn't need to take the hill out of that. So that would be pretty cool to get that many people in there.
It would, wouldn't it? 90,000 people in Croke Park in October. The only thing that Brian Peters would have to organise is the weather.
Yeah, that is
cold,
difficult.
Cold, wet night in Dublin in October. Is that really fit for boxing? I don't know. Never seen a boxing match in my life. Maybe it'd be absolutely perfect. But then the time difficulty, Marie. Mm-hmm. So like, if you're looking at the American market, and whatever way you look at it, and as much as we all want to see Katie Taylor fight in Dublin, and if you could sell 90,000 tickets, there is no doubt for a payday for Katie Taylor, it would sell out. Have you... I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
I can see myself buying tickets.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at a global audience and you want eyes on this, there's only 5 million of us in Ireland.
Yeah.
That's probably not enough. Will you get much of the British market? 65 million in England. How many of them are going to want to watch Amanda Serrano and Katie Taylor? I don't know is the honest answer to that one. You probably need the population of America to make it pay on TV.
Yeah, and the Zone, the way they work, they go off subscriptions and people paying for the fight. So they're going to want to go where all the people are, because the more people you have, the more money you're going to make. So it would be trying to convince them that this is something worth showing, even though it might not suit everything that they're looking for, but that the spectacle of it would attract enough attention. And that's hard to see. I feel there's an awful long way to go yet in this. I don't think we'll probably find out in the next few hours or anything, because there's a huge amount at play and there's a huge amount at stake as well for everybody involved, because this is as big as it gets for the sport in this country. And it's a way back as well after everything that happened, starting with that shooting at the Regency Hotel a number of years ago. It would be brilliant to rehabilitate the sport with something like that in Croke Park if they could get it right. But the way these things are, as we all know, they do come down to money and what people are getting paid. So that would probably dictate the outcome in this one, you'd have to think.
Can you see us all in Croke Park, 1 o'clock in the morning, waiting for the Americans to tune in? 8 p.m. East Coast time, Eastern Coast
time.
Yeah,
see the thing
about
it.
What time did she come into the ring in Madison Square Garden?
Well, it was 10 o'clock over there, or 10:30.
That was 3 a.m. 3:30 a.m. just can't see too many people. Like, imagine the uproar. We all hanging around Croke Park at 3:30 in the morning.
And the thing about it, something like that, when you're trying to sell 90,000 tickets for something, and it's like Katie Taylor and boxing and you know, a sporting idol, kids would fill a lot of that, you know, like parents and families, to have that moment together to experience something as historic like that. So you have to make it viable from that point of view as well, so that families can attend and just be part of the whole experience. So it, trying to put it on a little bit later can prove tricky.
Yeah, I know people will say, like, Katie Taylor, Irish, like, she should come and fight in Dublin for her Irish fans or whatever it is. But I suppose, Marie, when you look at someone like Katie Taylor, the last day, I'm sure, was a payday for her, but there's only going to be one or two more paydays. Like, you have to balance up the patriotism with the reality of making things pay.
Big time. And apparently she got a purse of estimated 2 million while Serrano received about 1 million, which is big money for women's boxing, for women's sport in general. So when you think that she was able to command that in America with all of those subscriptions and all of that attention on the fight and all those the people there and the zone on board so much, it's a lot of money. And if you even just do the maths on ticket sales, trying to get that from the gate, it would be hard to make that up over here if you don't have the same broadcast figures that you're going to get. So it is a tricky one.
Depends how much you're charging for the ticket. At 100 euros a ticket is 9 million. At 50 euros a ticket is 4.5 million. Then you have the costs, divvy it all up, get it all out. Yeah. Tricky one.
Yeah, it is a tricky one. Well, watch this space. Wherever it is anyway, Ruby, we'll be there. That's one thing I know.
You keep working on it. I was making phone calls last night. I was on too.
Our producer just told us we're going to take the roadcaster wherever we're going. It's official now. He said it.
Do we have to take the roadcaster to New York? You can go on the boat with the roadcaster.
I could make that fun. Bring the two Johnnies with us. It'd be great crack.
Yeah, we'll get them to come as well, though. We not just hire a bus in America, no? We all just get on a plane and go. How would we get a slot on a Saturday night? Do you think people would object if we took someone else's slot on a Saturday night?
I would be able to negotiate for it, you know?
Wouldn't we? Get the two Johnnies in before us. They can set out the Tree Arena, like, surely, like, that we'd be able to go.
Once they're on board, we're sorted, because, you know, they're the hottest ticket in 2FM at the moment. We always stick with the popular people, maybe. We'll be grand.
We're going in there tomorrow night doing the promo. Put a good word in for us.
We'll do. We'll get them on board. They'd only love it. They would absolutely love it.
Let it be their idea. But
even better.
The stipulation is it has to, you know, the game on has to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's take a very quick break. We have so much to get through today, keeping an eye on that Liverpool-Villarreal situation. It is lashing rain over there, but we hope that it goes ahead as planned.
RTE
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, European football.
Right, so Liverpool, we know, are playing Villarreal very, very shortly. It is live on RTE television. Kickoff is at 8 o'clock. Kevin Doyle joins us now to look ahead to the game. Kevin, I've been following some social media of Liverpool fans in Villarreal, and it is lashing out of the heavens over there. Will that suit either team better, do you think?
I don't know. I just hope the game goes ahead, Marie. I can't imagine either team would like it. Listen, Villarreal have to come back and score a minimum of 2 goals. So if it's a waterlogged pitch or not good conditions, that won't suit them either. So both teams will just want the game to go ahead. They don't want it to be postponed and have to come back another day.
Sorry, Marie, I was going to cut across you. If you look at Liverpool's dominance last Wednesday, 73% of the possession, winning 2-0, 19 shots compared to Villarreal's 1. Does a wet, soggy pitch not kind of suit Villarreal? Make it into a more of a bout than a soccer match, no?
I'd say if it was 0-0 and they were after coming away from Anfield, you know, with a result like that, they'd be happy. I'd say, listen, 2-0 down, they have to come out and play. They have to see if they can do what they did against Bayern or against Juventus, where they actually played some good stuff, some good counter-attacking football created, more than they did against Liverpool the other night. So they can play. I don't think they'll want a ball not bouncing or rolling or being able to break quickly, because that's the way they play. Listen, they sit deep, everyone behind the ball, try to break quickly, and a pitch that with the ball isn't moving well wouldn't suit them either.
Yeah, it's actually pretty mad, really, when you think that they have knocked out teams like Bayern and Juventus, and we're heading into this game and you're looking at Klopp's press conference and the questions he's been asked are, you know, is the job done already? And he's obviously then getting annoyed that people would even ask him that. But he won't underestimate them, but at the same time, you'd have to think that he'd be pretty confident going into it.
Yeah, yeah, listen, I think Villarreal, they set up to keep it, try keep it scores, and they'll try get them back their place, and it wasn't the case. They conceded two goals while playing very defensively, while having a lot of people behind the ball. So it's very difficult to see how they can come out and open up against Liverpool. Liverpool will love that. Villarreal have to come out and score, and that'll leave them vulnerable to a very dangerous forward line that Liverpool have. So listen, it's hard to see anything other than Liverpool going through here. I think the result in the first leg basically ended the tie. It should make for a good game though, because Villarreal have to come out, they have to score, so there should be plenty of chances at both ends.
Can we read anything into Unai Emery's comments that he's going to make them, while his team are going to make Liverpool hurt a little bit more today?
I don't think he means in a physical,
an Atletico kind of way.
Yeah, I think he means more in a, listen, get further, higher up the pitch, press them a bit more. I think they were very cautious at Anfield. They had to be. Listen, you can't go to Anfield. And they're a weaker squad, a weaker team. They're very good at playing a certain way. They were very good against Bayern and very good against Juventus. But they didn't get lay a foot on Liverpool. They didn't, every time they broke, they didn't create anything of any meaningfulness, any chances. As you said, as Ruby said, the stats there, one shot on target. I think he means that, you know, get more shots on target. Make Liverpool think, at least. Make them work for this win. Make them work to get into the final. I think they've lost it from what happened in the first leg, but at least put a glove on Liverpool in this game.
Obviously, the weekend, both managers were very conscious of this fixture coming up. Klopp made a couple of changes at Newcastle, but Emery rested 8 players for their trip to Alves and they got beaten. Does that kind of backfire, losing a match in the middle? Does that backfire towards you, to the morale?
It definitely is. Listen, winning is a habit. It's scoring goals is a habit. You know, keeping clean sheets is a habit. They're 7th, I think, in the league of Villarreal. It's never good losing games. Liverpool can afford to rest 2. I think they rested 3 players at the weekend because they've got a squad that enables them to do that. If some good, the players on the bench are as good as the ones that are playing. It's hard for Liverpool to pick a team. Villarreal can't do that. They have a strongest 11. You can understand why they did. They looked tired at the end of the game at Anfield. You understand why they're freshening up. To have any chance tonight, they had to sacrifice, I suppose, their game at the weekend to see if they could have any energy in their legs. Because the way Liverpool play and the way Villarreal are going to have to play tonight, take a tremendous amount of effort and energy. As I said, I think Liverpool still won't have too much from Doraway.
Give us a score prediction.
I think Villarreal will score a goal at home, but I think Liverpool will get 3-1 away win to Liverpool.
Right, well, I like the sound of that. Before we finish up, Kevin, there's just a little bit of breaking news today and yesterday about Stephen Bradley potentially heading to be the manager of Lincoln. Do you think that's the right move for him? And who do you think will take over in Shamrock Rovers if he does go there?
Yeah, I was just reading that before I came on to speak to you. I suppose it depends on what his goals are in his career. If he wants to go to England and try work his way up the managerial ladder, I met Stephen actually in the off-season. I was working on a game with him, and he, you know, I don't know him too well over the years. I played with him a couple of times, but he came across very well to me anyway, and he speaks very well about football, and he's done a fantastic job at Shamrock Rovers. And just listening to him talk and his ideas, I think he will be a successful manager. And I suppose he's done everything he can do in the League of Ireland with Shamrock Rovers. He has 3 league titles in a row, so, you know, it's a stepping stone for him. And if, you know, you want to move to, I suppose, the next level and work his way up. I don't think Lincoln in itself is a bigger club than Shamrock Rovers, but I think if he wants to work his way up in English football to a high level, that's probably the route he has to take.
It's just interesting as well, hearing the names linked with Shamrock Rovers, and one of them is Robbie Keane. Could you see that happening?
I don't know. I think I don't know what his ambitions are managerially. He has all his badges and all that, so nothing would surprise me. I think he's friends at the club behind the scenes as well, so you never know. Damien Duff has done it. Damien and Robbie be good friends. Damien's doing it with Shelburne, so nothing would surprise me in football, but I think it's unlikely, but I don't know.
Would you feel a little left out now? Damien Duff and Shelburne, Robbie Keane and Shamrock Rovers. Would you have to go to Waterford or somewhere? You have to get your run back in the league.
John O'Shea maybe to Waterford and then you to Wexford, and that would be a
clean sweep.
Yeah, might even get Ruby to go to some League of Ireland matches then.
Kildare Town.
I'll bring back Kildare United. No, listen, I played in the League of Ireland for a good few years, Ruby, so I got it out of my system where the lads, Damien didn't, and I think he wants to experience it and start off his managerial career. I'm busy enough as it is myself, but I wouldn't have the time.
I was slagging Marie and Adam Cawley last night. You played in Wolves a good while, Kevin, so you've lived in the Midlands in England.
Yeah.
It'd be a big change for Stephen Bradley going to Lincoln, come living in Dublin, playing with Shamrock or managing Stanmore Rovers.
Yeah, I've never been to Lincoln. Living in Dublin and managing Shamrock Rovers to living in Lincoln, I don't know if you the racetrack in Lincoln, have you been there?
Well, Leicester wouldn't be too far north of it. East Midlands would be your closest airport, but I'm not sure.
The only thing with Stephen, he's played in England as a youngster. He has been over there. He knows the country. So it wouldn't be Dublin, but it'd be pressure on him. Like, you know, it'd be a tough job going over there. There'd be unknown as a manager going there, and there'd be, like any job, management pressure straight away. You'd have to start off quickly. If you don't win your first few games, it's a tough job. So if he does take it, you'd have to admire him, because he's jumping from a job where he's doing very well and the main man and winning leagues to a club that needs help. So be interesting to see how it goes if he does take it.
It would indeed. Kevin Doyle, thanks for talking to us. Enjoy the game.
Cheers, Ruby. Cheers, Marie.
Bye.
Game on. Football. RTE.
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
Now it is time to turn our attention to hurling, and I'm delighted to say that Paddy Maher joins us on the line. Paddy, the last time we were talking to you, you hadn't retired yet. You were very close to it, though, after being injured. How's things been since you have announced your retirement?
Yeah, it's fairly pretty strange, Marie, to be honest with you. I know it is a bit of a change, all right, taking out a routine that I was kind of involved in for my whole adult life, you could say. So, a bit strange, but, yeah, getting to do other things now in my life and, probably not under as much pressure as they say, but, strange times, all right.
Are the other things in your life filling the void that hurling has left, though?
To be honest with you, I'd say, Ruby, it'd be hard to ever fill the void. You know yourself when you're so involved in something, like, we'll say, for me, it was hurling, obviously, and it means so much to them, just taken away, so it's tough, all right, but, I'm doing other things there, trying to fill the time, all right, you know, doing a bit of running and golf and things like that, so you'd be trying to, I suppose, keep that competitive mindset, you know, to keep you going, doing something every day, you know, that kind of way. So, but yeah, I've had enough things to keep me going to fill the void, in fairness.
I saw on Instagram there before we came on air that you had ran the half marathon. So you're not just going for a few jogs, you're putting in the miles, you're going racing, I guess.
Yeah, I've done that there on Sunday, and it's very enjoyable now. And it's something to kind of, I suppose, it's kind of a name. You know, I signed up for a couple of months back when I got the news about my neck, so I said to keep the head, you know, focused on something, you know, so it is good like that, like, and I won't be breaking any records anytime soon going by Sunday anyway, but look to the start anyway, we'll see, we might do another one soon enough.
And Paddy, is that you finished now with hurling? Like, is there any way at all you could do any sort of level, or are you done?
No, it's kind of, that's it, because when the doctor advised me that with whatever damage I'd done, he said, like, I suppose club has gone so competitive now, and club has gone so, you know, professional as well with their approach and training and everything, that you could easily do as much damage in a club game or club training as you would do in the county. So he said, look, take what you have now and get out without any major worries or major injuries, he said, and don't take the risk. And I've had a good time of it. So I took his advice, and that's pretty much it.
It's a little bit different to you, Ruby, because when you retired, you can still go riding. Like, you're still riding out for Willie. Do you think if it was taken away from you completely, that you wouldn't maybe have dealt with retirement as well as you seem to be doing?
I had never thought of that, Marie, but I never was faced with the words that you should get out before you do yourself serious harm either. So very different scenario for me than it was for Paddy, but they are frightening words when a doctor says to you, like, you have to pull up before something happens to you. So I never had to face that, but Paddy, you did. And I was just listening to a couple of interviews with you during the day. The neck injury, the headaches, are you still getting the headaches or have they subsided now? Has the injury healed itself enough that you're not in any pain, really?
No, I'm actually grand. I'm pain-free, to be honest with you, Ruby, too, as I suppose the fact that I was getting them, I'm getting to the club just before we played the county final there last year in November. I just started getting them the week before the match. I thought they thought maybe it was vertigo or something, but then obviously I went and got the scans and stuff after the when the club was finished up and that, and then they showed up a thing in one of my arteries in my neck. So that was they were pretty much happy to see, to say that was causing the dizziness and the headaches. And ever since I stopped doing, I suppose, physical contact and training, like, and hitting off lead and all that that comes with it, no, I've been fine, perfect. As I said, doing all the running and doing all, I can do gym work, swimming, the whole lot, and getting no reaction, so it is great.
Any ambition to run a whole marathon?
Yeah, sure, straight away. When I got the news, I said I better sign up for something. I was going to do the half one, and then I was talking to a lad that would do a nice few of them, and he said, no, hold your horses. He says, build it up. He says, I took his advice, and going from last Sunday's one, anyway, I'm glad I did.
you know what comes next now, don't you? After that, you did the half marathon, the full marathon, and then it's the Ironman, like.
I don't think I'm mad enough for that.
I'd say you are. I'm able to swim, I'm able to go to the gym, I'm able to run. That'll be the next one for Paddy Maher.
Oh, jeez, no, I'm not mad enough to be able to do that now at the moment, I don't think.
Paddy, you're talking to us today to draw attention towards the Darkness into Light walks for Pieta House, and they're happening this weekend. Why did you get involved with this?
Yeah, sure, look, I suppose I was always aware of Darkness into Light and all the work Pieta had done. And when the lads asked me to, when, you know, I suppose True Electric Ireland, they're the sponsors, to get involved and help promote it and give it one last push there last week for this Saturday, you know, I was absolutely delighted to be involved, to get asked to be involved and help them out, because it's such a good cause. And I suppose, you know, we all can only tell, you know, someone that, you know, that's used their service, or that has, that, you know, a family or a friend that has suffered from mental health or a suicide in the family. And, you know, I see a lot of it through my job as well as a guard on Limerick, that, you know, people suffering from mental health issues, you know, suicide, you know. So you know, I'm definitely well aware, and I see the effects it has on people, you know. So when the lad asked me to get involved, I jumped at it, you know. I said, I can do to help, and you know, hopefully they get good register numbers now in the next few days before Saturday.
And obviously as well, Paddy, just given the fact you've played on so many teams, and, you know, you've been connected to so many young men, and you know, the statistics tell us that it is often young men who really suffer and are slow to talk. And, you know, we saw a terrible tragedy in Clare a few weeks ago, and there was another one in Sligo as well, both involved in the GAA communities. Do you find, or have you found, maybe throughout your career, as the younger lads are joining panels, are people talking as much as they used to maybe 15 years ago when you were starting out?
I suppose people are a bit more, I suppose, aware of, you know, the people are listening, are willing to help and talk it out. And but, like, I think as men in general, we are quiet when it comes to that, or, you know, even might get a bit embarrassed maybe to talk about something like that. And, you know, GPA being great, I can see, you know, I've often seen over the years how GPA can help you, you know. And you know, there's great services there, you know, like, you know. So look, I think in general, as young men, we would be kind of, you know, slower to turn to someone to express, you know, what we're going through, you know. And then I suppose the last few years, then with COVID and everything, you know, even you see there yourself, my own experience there, like, you know, taking out a routine is through COVID, you know, even I found that tough myself, you know, your routine, what you're used to, you know, everyone's taken away from it. And then, you know, so people have other bigger issues in to deal with as well. And, you know, we probably only hear a quarter or a third of them, you know, people, you know, things go on in the background of people's lives that we don't hear, you know. So that's why the Darkness into Light and Pieta are so important, just, you know, to help, I suppose, raise as much funds as we can this week, that, you know, it'll help improve, you know, all the services, 24-hour services, you know, that people are using. And, you know, the lads were telling me last week they could be getting up to 200,000 calls and texts, you know, so it's so important that people support this week, and it'd be great if we can get it.
It's easy for you or I to say talk and seek help, but people finding the encouragement to get that help or finding the courage to get that help is another thing. And the availability of all those services, the numbers, the readiness of it, it all costs a lot. And something like what Darkness Into Light does raise money that can keep people there all the time.
Exactly, yeah. Like all the Atoms raised this week or next weekend, next Friday and Saturday is going directly back into their services. Like, so that shows how important it is. And look, as I said, so many people are using the services there. Like, them numbers are frightening. Like, you know, and as I was saying there, like, the last 2 years, like, as I said, I see my own job here. Like, you know, people's, I suppose, mental health has suffered, and in the last few years, you know, so, you know, it's so important. A small phone call or you know, someone meeting in through Pieta, you know, how we can help someone in their lives. You know, people might be looking for a bit of help and might be crying out for a bit of help. You know, and you know, that's why these services are so essential. You know, and look, and I suppose it's time of year now. Everyone's trying to fundraise for different things and clubs and organisations and that. But I suppose we've seen over the last 2 years, you know, before COVID, how important Pieta is and the support the Darkness Into Light gets. So hopefully that'll continue this week now.
Yeah, and as you did say as well, like, the last few years have been so tough for people because they've been isolated. And look, we're all involved in sport and delighted to see crowds back. But I guess on a human level, it's a way for people to connect as well and to start talking again and meeting people and just kind of get that routine back and have something to look forward to. And, you know, we spend an awful lot of time giving out about our teams and how results are going and all the rest, but there's so much value in just having that action on the pitch, you know, even if it's Tipperary and they're not going well, at least it's something to talk about anyway, buddy.
Yeah, you know, I suppose we were crying out for all that the last few years, you know, was taken away from us, you know, and all the good to go back to games, and it's great. And look, while it means so much to us all, and, you know, while the results are important, you know, I suppose, as you mentioned there, the tragedies in Sligo, and that it brings it all back down to, look, it's just there for enjoyment, and it's there to bring us all together as a community. And, you know, as I said, give us something to talk to, give us the people a way of meeting up and doing something that they all love doing. So, look, while it is so important, it's not to be all and end all, and there's bigger and more important things in our lives.
Well, it does give us all something to talk about. So what's the conversation been in the Maher House now with the way Tipperary are going? They're getting beaten by Waterford, beaten by Clare, Limerick are coming next, then Cork, the final match. Probably a different conversation than one you used to have, but surely you have plenty of opinion about it.
Yeah, look, I suppose the lads are probably finding it tough at the moment. And look, I've been in that position myself where you're coming off the back of a bad loss or a bad performance, and you know, people are getting on their back, like, but that's all part and parcel of inter-county, you know, hurling and football, you know. And guys have to take in the chin and move on and try and improve. They had 2 weeks from the Clare game now to this game on Sunday against Limerick, you know. And look, no one will give them a chance, and look, in a way, it could be the ideal opportunity from the way they're going into it. No one's giving them a hope, you know. Limerick are steamrolling everyone at the moment, and you know, but they have to take in the chin and try and get something from the match. There's no point feeling sorry for themselves. You know, I obviously still very friendly with a lot of the boys involved, and my brother's playing as well. And, you know, they've been training very well, apparently, since the Clare game, and spirits are good again. Now, obviously, they were down after the Clare game, but they picked themselves back up, and so they're looking forward to it, as far as I know, next Sunday. So it'd be great, first of all, if they can get a good performance and improve from the last 2 days, and then see what result comes from it.
We know when we're looking at Limerick and when they're at their peak that they're, you know, there's no point going out trying to do what they're doing, trying to replicate the way that they play, because they have those unique players that have the skill set to do what they do. But how do you contain them? Like, how can Tipperary contain them and ultimately beat them in championship, in Munster championship this weekend?
Yeah, you know, I said it's very, very difficult. Sure. Like, Limerick are, you know, at the moment, they're ahead of everyone, and they're a good bit ahead of everyone from what I can see so far. And you know, there's no point going out, as you said, they're trying to, you know, copy exactly what they're doing. You still have to use your own, you know, strengths. And, you know, I suppose even last year, I suppose if you look at the Munster final in the first half, we managed to get a bit of a roll, and you know, that was kind of, we were playing our own kind of type of game that day. And it was just we kind of ran out of steam in the second half and obviously Limerick upped their levels. But look, people, it's very hard to go, you know, as you said the last day, people are fancying Waterford, but then Waterford just, you know, walked into Limerick's kind of game plan really, and that the middle third just you know, bodies everywhere, they were turning over the ball, they were winning frees, you know, suiting Limerick down to the ground. So look, obviously someone has to come up with a way of beating them, but at the moment, and we've seen it for the last few years, no one can seem to come up with a way of beating Limerick at the moment, and that's why they're so good at, you know, that's why Paul Kinnock is so, such an important asset to him. He's able to have him fine-tuned and play whatever way it needs to be. That you never see Limerick changing their game plan too much to play anyone, whereas everyone seems to have to try and come up with something to beat Limerick.
Paddy, you didn't miss a championship match for Tipperary since 2009, I think, until this year.
That's right, I think, yeah.
Do you find yourself looking at Tipperary differently now you're on the outside looking in? Do you find yourself watching games differently, seeing what lads are doing differently? Do you have a different tactical take on it almost?
Yeah, I suppose I'm getting to go to a lot more games than I used to being able, obviously, when I was involved. But, yeah, you're kind of watching them through, I suppose, kind of, what way would you put it, kind of through a coach's eyes, if that makes sense. You'd be trying to see what other teams are doing, what way players are playing, what way teams are setting up, like, and I suppose no different for me looking at Tipperary, like, not to see what way they're doing or what way they want to go about it. And see, that's the thing about Tip at the moment too, they're probably changing the style of play a bit, and look, they're not going to do it, it's not going to work straight away, they're going to have to get used to, and that mightn't happen until next year, you know, it could take 12 months for that to develop. But you know, a lot of teams are starting to change, and it's not Tip or no different. And I suppose, look, unlike any supporter now, I would be in my own head kind of saying, oh, geez, why didn't do this or do that, or would that be critical? But at the end of the day, I'm trying to stand back and say, look, I was already involved there last year. I know what these guys are going through, so I'm trying to sympathise with it a bit, if that makes sense.
What way would you like to see them play? Like, what for you, what's their ideal game plan?
It's hard to know, I suppose. People, I see a lot of the local media at home were kind of crying out after last day for Tip to go back to their old Tipperary values and Tipperary way of playing. Like, and look, I think that can happen. They can play the Tipperary way, as they say, with a bit more kind of, you know, flexibility, more movement in the pitch, I suppose, delivering the ball into the forwards nice and quick. But I think you can use that along with you can marry it a bit with the kind of, I suppose, more modern style now of kind of, you know, working the ball through the lines to a certain extent up the field, but at a certain stage in the pitch, then you can inflict the Tipperary way, if they call it, and get the ball into the forwards as quick as possible, because that's what they want. Like, and you know, but it's, I suppose Tipper just trying to, you know, if they were going to more traditional, it hasn't been working the last few years, so they have to change something up.
No, it sounds easy in theory, but you know yourself, the reality is not that simple, is it?
No, look, it takes a lot of. Look, it's a lot of work on the training ground, and the Tipper already back in since January, like, and the championship was in April, and they were trying to try change up their game plan a bit. So that's why I mean that people need a lot of patience in the county, and that it mightn't see the benefits of it until next year, maybe, and like everyone gets used to it. And you know, Limerick are at their way of playing and style of playing now. They're at for a good five, six years now under John Kiley and Paul Kinnock, so like they're well used to it. Waterford are going well under Liam Cahill, they're in the third year of that cycle, so. You can see the benefits of them sticking to it. So I suppose hopefully Tip can get it right, hopefully in the next 12 months as well, and we'll see the benefits down the line then again.
Unfortunately, Paddy, though, patience and sports fans are words that rarely go together, so it might be a difficult 12 months ahead. But come here, thanks so much for talking to us, and we all know how important Pieta House is and their fundraiser Darkness into Light. The countdown is on and there's plenty of time for people to sign up as well, so check it out online and on social media and donate to a great cause, or get out and do the walk as well over the weekend. Paddy, thank you, we'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, lads. Thanks.
Cheers, Paddy. Game on. Hurling. So last night in Sheffield, Ronnie O'Sullivan won his seventh world title to join Stephen Hendry on seven championships. And a former world champion was there to watch him. Ken Doherty joins us on the line. Ken, Rocket Ronnie O'Sullivan, is he a greater snooker player than Stephen Hendry?
Oh, yeah. I think he was even before last night, but it certainly cemented him, really. You know, to equal Stephen Hendry's record of seven world championships. I think that was his main goal. Since he got very, very close, and he's broken every other record in the in the snooker record books, and now he's equaled sort of the king of the Crucible, who was Stephen Hendry. But yeah, without a doubt, he's the best player that's ever lived. I don't think we'll ever see, you know, another Ronnie O'Sullivan, because he's one of those characters in our sport that, you know, only come around, and maybe, you know, that maybe only come around once in a lifetime, you know, or once in a whole sort of history of the sport. And, you know, he's just an absolute genius.
It's so fascinating watching him, Ken. Mm. The emotion afterwards, he was so, the tears and the hugs with the family, and then with Joe Trump as well. And it was such a beautiful moment, and seeing what it meant him. But then, you know, time passes, a couple of hours later, he does interviews and he said that he doesn't care about the accolades. So it's really hard to try and figure out which one it is. The emotions say he does, but the words say he doesn't.
Yeah, right, yeah. He's a bit of an enigma in that way. You know, he sort of plays down a lot of stuff. He doesn't, he says he doesn't, you know, really care about records, but deep down you could see how much he wanted to win that, and how much it meant to him, with the tears at the end, you know, and particularly the uncomfortable, like, couple of minutes home with Joe Trump that went on for a little bit too much of a long and for a man hug, you know, but it was very emotional. It's good to see a bit of emotion. But the other side, when you see him playing down, or, you know, saying that he doesn't care, I don't believe that for a minute. I really believe he really cared. He wanted to win it. You could see the determination in his face. And when he got really angry, when he messed up, like, here or there within the matches, like particularly the semi-final against John Higgins, and indeed the final against Joe Trump, you knew how much it really meant to him, you know.
It's 21 years since he beat John Higgins to win his first. He's 30 years a professional snooker player.
Yeah.
He is an enigma. How does he last that long?
I think dedication. You know, commitment, dedication, the love of the sport, you know, and the sort of the graft that he puts in as well, Ruby. You know, all those things. I mean, we're sort of lucky in our sport. It's not a physical sport, so it's a bit like golf, a bit like sort of darts, that you can go on, you can prolong your career if you look after yourself, you look after your body. He's very into his fitness. You know, he's had his mental health problems. He's worked with Steve Peters over the last, like, 10 or 12 years, which has really helped him off the table. And, he's just, I mean, he runs, like, 10 miles a day. You know, he go into the gym at, like, 9 o'clock in the morning. He'd be playing his session at, like, 2 o'clock in the final, and he'd be in the gym running, like, you know, his 8 or 10 miles every day. And that's what sort of keeps him sane. That's what keeps him... keeps him ticking over. That's what he loves doing more than anything. Probably just as much as he loves playing snooker, he loves his running, and that's what keeps him fit and healthy and in a good state of mind.
But it is mindset, because, like, he's 10 months older than Ray Reardon was when he won his world championship. But if you look at Stephen Hendry, Steve Davis at 35, and it's something Ronnie has said, they started to wane from 35, as well as all that physical work. His mental capacity to stay where he is incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah, his mental fortitude, you know, is second to none. You know, his ambition, his insatiable appetite for success and for the big tournaments. You know, he gets himself up for the big ones. You know, he's won 7 Masters, he's won 7 UK Championships, and now he's won 7 World Championships. That's 21 of our Triple Crown events, you know, more than anybody has ever done in the game. It's quite an incredible. He's won, like, 39, I think, ranking tournaments. He's had over, like, nearly almost 1,200 century breaks. You know, Stephen Hendry was the best before him on 700, and now Judd and Robertson are on 800 plus. But yeah, it's just incredible, you know. And that 147 that he did 25 years ago in the World Championship in 5 minutes and 8 seconds, well, that will never be beaten either, you know. So he's just an absolute genius and a brilliant talisman for a sport. Whether you love him or hate him, or you don't like what he says in his interviews, and listen, I'd be one of his biggest critics in his interviews of the way he plays down the sport, or he's talked the sport down loads and loads of times. But you can't help but love the way he plays the game. It's just so beautiful, and without doubt, he's one of the best characters that we've ever had in our sport.
What kind of a person is he? Because often when you're looking at these guys on television and they're at the top of their game, you have a perception of the type of person that they are. And it doesn't always end up being like that, as I found out working with Ruby. They're often much nicer
exactly
than you think they're going to be. What's he like?
You know, something like, you don't know. I've known him since he was about 12. You know, his father used to send a taxi for me down to his house in Ilford when I moved over, back in the late 80s, and I used to practice him from the age of 12. And, you know, I still wouldn't know him type of way, you know, because he'd be different, complex. He's a very complex sort of character. But at the same time, he's very down to earth. He's very, you know, you saw how the emotion was. Like, he'd be one guy 1 minute, and the next day, he'd be a different guy. Like, you know what I mean? But that's the way he is. You know, he's had a tough upbringing as well. You know, his father went to prison when he was only, like, 16 years of age. His sister was, like, 14, and his father went away for life. So he's had a lot of those problems from a very, very young age that he's had to deal with, you know? And that's, but like, he's been a very complex character from a very, very young age because of his problems, like, in the family home. But he's, you know, he's very honest about it. He's very open about it. And I think down, you know, deep down, he's a very, very genuine, very caring type of guy. And as we saw last night, very emotional as well.
Whatever about his conduct in interviews or whatever else, nobody can question his numbers at the Crucible. 74 matches won, 199 centuries made, 1,182 frames won, 3 1-4-7s, and over £3 million in prize money. Yeah. I like figures, but they're impressive.
Yeah. You were always good with figures, really. Yeah, I mean, the figures are outstanding, you know, and... you know, 1 year, I mean, one of the most incredible things that he's ever done that people sort of overlook was he gave up snooker for a whole year. He became world champion 1 year. He gave up snooker. He never played another tournament, and he came back for the world championships the following year, and he won that again. He defended his title. You know, that's he can play left-handed, he can play right-handed. He's just a genius, you know. And, you know, it's just, even when I was there, you know, commentating, watching him play, it was just like, you know, he'd make the hairs in the back of your neck stand up. You're just in awe of him, how he can play, almost like he's playing in the snooker club, you know, when it means nothing. Yet he's in the sort of the heat of the Crucible when it means everything, and he's on the precipice to winning 7 world championships and equals Stephen Hendry's record. It was just magical stuff. It was just wonderful to be there, you know.
He outlined afterwards as well just how tough it is to win there, and just how difficult he found the whole, I guess, the slog of it, you know, all the games. Yeah. Will we see more?
I hope so. I hope he comes back. I mean, and don't forget, like, he's had this film crew going around with him, like, all the time while he's been here at the crew. Well, they've been going around with him for the last
the
6 months.
Last time I saw a fella with a film crew going around with him, he retired.
Sir Anthony McCoy.
Well, these people have been going. He's been mic'd up throughout this world championship, apparently.
Yeah, that sounds familiar too.
Yeah. So the documentary, I don't know when it's coming out or whether it's going to be on Netflix or Amazon Prime or stuff like that. So he's had all to deal with that as well. Now, whether he retires or not, he says, like, this is enough and I've just equaled Stephen Hendry. I think he'll come back. He'll want to win 8. You know, the fact that he's equal Stephen Hendry, he'll want to beat him now, you know. And I think he still has that hunger and desire to be to win as many of these majors and Triple Crown events that he can do, you know. And I hope he does.
Yeah, so do I, because he was just unbelievable entertainment over the last little while, and we'd hope to see so much more of him. Ken Doherty, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. An absolute
pleasure.
Now, before we finish up for the evening, we are going to turn our attention to the Champions League and the small matter of Liverpool and Villarreal, which will be taking place in just over an hour, and it is live on RTE television. To talk us through the team news, I'm delighted to say that Mark Langdon of the Racing Post is with us. Mark, do we have some team news?
Yes, yeah, we do. Liverpool, very strong, as you would expect, really. You know, the usual back four in terms of the Champions League, with Konate alongside Van Dijk, with Robertson, Alexander-Arnold, either side of those. The midfield, Thiago, Keita and Fabinho. And then up front, you've just got... He's got so many options, hasn't he, Jurgen Klopp? He's gone obviously, this time with Mo Salah, Jota and Mane as the front three. Mane and Jota can both play through the middle or as the number nine. I think the big news as far as Villarreal are concerned is Gerard Moreno, their best striker, the Spanish international forward, who missed out on that first leg at Anfield when Villarreal didn't really offer too much. He's back. So he's back up front with Danjuma, and Lo Celso is in midfield with Coquelin, Capoue and Pereiro. And then at the back, it's Foyt, Albiol, Torres and Estupiñán, who scored their own goal in the first leg, and Rui is in goal. So I think Villarreal have got a more attacking lineup tonight. Of course, you know, they need to play on the front foot. They need to be more adventurous than they were at Anfield. I suspect that this tie, as long as Liverpool don't do anything, you know, completely out of character, Liverpool should be able to manage this 90 minutes quite comfortably.
Kevin Doyle gave us a prediction of a 3-1 victory to Liverpool. Would you be as optimistic as him?
I don't know if I'd go that high. I suspect Liverpool will win. I'd probably go for a one sort of narrow victory, maybe by a goal, maybe 2-1. Like I say, I think Villarreal have got more attacking options tonight, and it would be good to see them play on the front foot and try to cause Liverpool a few more problems. There was some criticism of their performance last week when they barely managed a shot in the entire game, but I just think that was because Liverpool were so good. Unai Emery said after the game it wasn't the plan to be that defensive. We just couldn't get out against Liverpool's press, and always think Liverpool press better when Jordan Henderson's playing, so maybe it won't be quite as relentless tonight, but I expect Liverpool to win and not have too many concerns.
Kevin Doyle also had some concerns about the pitch and the weather. How are things looking over there?
Oh. Yeah, wet, very wet. For the Liverpool fans that have made the trip over to Spain, I think if you go to Spain in May, you're expecting T-shirt, shorts and plenty of sunshine. It's been a relentless downpour. I know somebody that's in Spain, staying in Valencia before the game in Villarreal, which is like the neighbouring city, and it's been pretty relentless. It looks like it's easing up just in time for kickoff. There was a threat at one stage today that maybe the game wouldn't even go ahead. I think we've got past that stage, thankfully, and it will go ahead. But certainly wetter than I'm sure the Liverpool fans would have been expecting, those that have made the trip.
And Mark, what do you think about tomorrow night? Real Madrid and Man City, an unbelievable first game. 4-3 is the scoreline. Will it be an all-English final in Paris?
I think it will, yeah. I mean, Real Madrid will be sort of thankful, weren't they, really, after that first leg performance, because I think Man City could have been out of sight. The performance, particularly sort of going forward, I think deserved more than just a one goal advantage. I thought it was very interesting today. Ancelotti and Luka Modric did press conferences and both said they've got to defend better at Real Madrid because they didn't defend well in that first game. Casemiro return, I think, is a big one for Real Madrid because his absence was sorely felt at the Etihad, and I'm sure that they will be tighter defensively, and they've got Benzema and Vinicius in attack. But I still think that City have got the better quality in sort of, you know, in most of the key areas. And if they play like they did in the first leg, I would be surprised if Real Madrid overturn the deficit. They do say never rule out Real Madrid in the Champions League. In Spain, they just always believe that Real Madrid can come back from anything. And, you know, it's only one goal. But I do think that City and Liverpool are the two best teams in Europe, and I really hope that we do get to see them playing it out in Paris, you know, for the biggest trophy of the lot.
I don't know. I'd love to see Liverpool, Real Madrid battling it out for the biggest trophy. I just like the fact that it's a team like Real Madrid who have so much tradition and history. I guess maybe it's the novelty of Manchester City and Liverpool, and they play so often that doesn't it holds the same attraction for me, and also the fact that Manchester City are so good.
Yeah, I think it might be something to do with the fact that they're so good, and Real Madrid would be an easier final. I do appreciate that. I think European ties are generally better when it's, you know, teams from different countries. That's the whole point of the competition. I just think, you know, Klopp and Guardiola going at it again for the Champions League would be guaranteed a really good game, and that's what I always hope for in a final.
Big match in the Championship tonight as well, Mark. Nottingham Forest and Bournemouth, with one of them is looking to claim that automatic promotion spot in second. At the moment, Bournemouth lead Forest by 3 points, but Forest have a way superior goal difference. So it's a big clash tonight, and Forest are bang in form.
That they are, yeah. I mean, it's almost like a sort of playoff before the playoffs, really, because, you know, the opportunity for Bournemouth maybe to go up, or if Forest did go above them with a victory, you wouldn't imagine that they would blow it on the final day. Steve Cooper has done an incredible job in sort of getting Forest from a team that was really struggling under Chris Hughton to playing some unbelievably good football. Worrell at the back is somebody, I think, destined for the Premier League. Brennan Johnson as well plays sort of in those wide positions, another one that looks too good for the Championship. Bournemouth's lead has just been eaten away for several months. They've got some decent players and some big-name players for the Championship level. I think if you just look at it purely on form, I think you would, even though they're away from home, I think you'd have to fancy Nottingham Forest to win the game. And I always think that, you know, it can be very clear in your mind here. Like, Bournemouth know a draw is a good result for them. Forest know, really, they've got to win. And so they can just attack the game. And sometimes you do see that teams that are in two minds whether to play normally or play for a draw end up sort of messing it up completely. So I think I'd rather be in Forest's position, even though Bournemouth have got that point advantage at the moment. I just think that Forest are playing so well. One at Fulham recently, you know, it would be a remarkable achievement. I think they might be able to do it.
Mark Langdon, thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully that rain will dry up for the Liverpool-Villarreal match a little bit later on. We will check in with you again very, very soon. Just a little bit of news before we finish up. Wes Houlihan's two-year stint at Cambridge United has come to an end. The statement has just been released, and Mark Bonner, the manager, said that he is the most talented player that he's seen play for the club. He's 39 and he is finishing up after two seasons. I'm sure the Wes Houlihan to Shelburne rumours will start up again. Ruby, when you get your Shelburne jersey now, you can put Wes on the back of it.
Where does Shelburne play again? Talca Park, isn't it?
Yeah. It's going to be your first big game, is it?
It will be, yeah.
Right, well, that is all we have time for this evening. Ruby, thank you so much, as
Cheers,
always.
Marie.
Tara Kumar is up next.